The big question, and this changes for everyone, is why do you buy a wine? And do you know where that wine actually comes from?
As I like to say, there's life after Cabernet Sauvignon.
The most expensive wine in the world is a Bloody Merlot. Why can't we be in that group? We can be.
It is important to adapt your rootstock to the location where you are and what you want to grow.
There's a moment in a red wine fermentation where it gets really foamy, froths up in your face, and it smells amazing. I think that's my favorite part.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 308. This week we feature Brian Hosmer of Chateau Chantal, Traverse City, Michigan. With this program, we have reached the end of our Michigan wineries tour, and it's been an eye-opening experience. We'll be visiting Michigan again likely this summer to discover more of the state's wealth of wineries. But today we feature winemaker Brian Hosmer of Chateau Chantal in Traverse City. Chateau Chantal is a big, beautiful winery on Old Mission Peninsula, offering a diverse selection of wines, incredible views, as well as a bed and breakfast. Once again, the ground was covered in heavy snow as we made our way up the long driveway. Brian was an excellent interview, telling us about unnamed grapes, life on the peninsula, and the science of making good wine.
I'm here with Brian Hosmer, and we are at Chateau Chantal, and we are in Traverse City. We are on the, which peninsula are we on here?
The Old Mission Peninsula.
Old Mission, right. You knew that.
Yes.
You passed the test. You can keep your job.
Wow. I come here a lot.
You know? Yeah, you do. On a day like today, where there's a little bit of snow going on outside, as it continues with our tour of Michigan wineries.
It's appropriate. That's when we get here in the winter, it protects us.
You guys laid out the white carpet for us, didn't you?
Yeah, the white carpet for sure.
Yeah, thanks for nothing.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, no problem.
I guess the first thing I'm going to ask you is, how long have you been a winemaker here?
I've been here since 2007, so I think 11, 12 years now.
Great. So you've got a good amount of time in here. How long have you been a winemaker?
A couple years before that, so about almost 15 years now.
When did you get your start?
I started at Michigan State University. I worked in the research vineyard and winery there under Stan Howell. I was his last grad student he brought in and got to work and spent a lot of time. He sat me down. He was like, well, if you had your druthers, would you decide to go into the vineyard or the winery? And I had to decide that day and tried to tell him, oh, you know, if the good fruit comes from the vineyard. And he's like, well, if you had your druthers, I was like, well, I want to be a winemaker. So I ended up spending a lot of time in the research winery there. We do a couple hundred batches of complete randomness every day.
But then again, you still ended up spending a fair amount of time in the vineyard, right? I
mean, it's obviously a part of it. You can't avoid it. Kind of dependent on it. It is essentially your lifeline.
No, so why would you want to, though? I mean, that's the best part of the job, I think.
Yeah, and the cellar doesn't have many windows, so it's nice to go out and remind yourself that things are alive and going out in the summertime. You know, it's a beautiful place, too, and so even working in some of these vineyards, you can see the bay from it, and where we're sitting now, you have pictures of those, you can show everybody that it's just, can't see it now, but right over there, there's West Bay, and it's pretty deep.
Yeah, it's way out there.
It protects us, too. It's just like the snow.
Yeah. How high are we here?
1,300 feet.
So we're pretty good, then. Do you have a fog line here at all? Or?
No, it's not the same here. Just because the water is always right there, it's not too far, so fog isn't one of the things that we depend on, just because we have, you know, the lakes are the big deal here, and that what's going on in them always kind of dictates what's happening to us. It's kind of like a mini ocean, you know, and so in the spring, when they're cold, it radiates cold, and the vines don't bloom out in the spring, and they stay dormant longer, so we don't worry about cold frosts like you do in more centralized parts of the country, or even 10 miles that way into town, 15 miles that way, they'll start budding out, and then you get a cold front coming through, and you'll be off your primaries into your secondaries and a couple times, and that's no good. And then the reverse happens in the fall, where it extends the season and makes it longer because it's radiating heat.
I'm seeing a picture on the wall of clearly harvest and a guy with an FYB standing there covered, and it looks like he's harvesting during snow. So yep. That could be either ice vine or just plain old snow at harvest.
Oh, it's definitely ice vine.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah, we do that. We try it. It's still out there right now. We're waiting for it. For the size of this hill, we get such a big temperature variation between top and bottom. We can't really pick it at the normal temperatures around 15 to 17 Fahrenheit. We wait for about 13 to 15 so that they're all frozen solid. And so we're just waiting for a couple of days like that. And we generally do that. And we've successfully done it in December in the 12 years I've been here, like once, twice maybe. And usually it's January. And so we're out there watching the temperatures and you're picking them up and they're like hard little marbles. And that's what we're aiming for. So you put them in the press and it's rolling around. It does sound like little marbles rolling around.
Yeah, I bet it does. Does that take a much longer period of time to create the press? I mean,
to press, yeah. Yeah, so a normal press cycle might last, you know, a couple hours if it's completely full and a handful of other variables. But this, I have a program set up that runs at least 6 hours because what happens is when you're pressing it, the juice, you know, normal juice is, you know, 20, 22 bricks, which is about roughly percent sugar, right? And then when you press ice wine, you want it to be about double that. And so we're aiming for around 40. Maybe wow. We want to start at 46 because then it comes down a little bit. And so the juice is so thick and viscous and cold, it rolls really, really slowly through the channels of the press. And so each hold has to be a lot longer. And then you ramp up pressure much slower and it just takes a much longer time. And so, but we've been pretty lucky with the ice wine here. We have a special little block over there. We have some call proprietary white blend of varieties that very few other people have. Some of them don't even have names yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really fun stuff.
What are the typical ones, though?
Typical ice wine grapes?
Other grapes, yeah.
Generally, it's made from Riesling, and that's a part of it. And then we have a few other grapes in there that very early on, even Mark, the guy that started this winery, he was into bringing in other varieties and trying new things out. And so we have some that aren't even named that were bred in Geisenheim called like GM318.57. And oh yeah, beautiful names. And
so, it's sexy.
Oh yeah, it sells. Put them on every bottle, you know. And so that's one of them. And then, so these are things you can't even really get your hands on. And so it adds a different character to the ice wine. And a few years ago, we got a call. We're in a management meeting and we're like, oh, the White House is on the phone. We're like, yeah, sure, yeah, some guy at the house that's white, sure, you know. And then Marie, our CEO, goes down and talks to him and she comes back. She's like, it was the White House, it was the sommelier for Obama's administration. It was like, we wanted to have our ice wine for when Trudeau came to town. And so we weren't allowed to tell anybody because it was like, you can't use that as a promotional thing, so they don't want to be seen as promoting certain products over others. But you know, then they did publish the menu after the fact and we could tell people about it. But it was nice. It's kind of cool, you know.
So that's a big honor.
Yeah we couldn't donate it, you know. They have to pay for everything, so everything was above board. And it was pretty cool to see them cheersing with pitchers and, you know, with our wine, like, oh wow, you know, it's cool. You know, we make, you know, this year we just ran through probably 60,000-70,000 gallons of wine, and you know, we're hoping to have 100 gallons of ice wine. So in context, you realize, you know, when you're handling those tanks and you know that tank's, you know, almost like $50,000 to $100,000, and you're like, it's a tiny little tank, you know, this is crazy.
I wouldn't even think about it.
Yeah, and you know, most very often it'd be the amount that we would like be a racking loss that we'd forget about other days, but the way it's treated. You know,
everywhere here has been tremendously nice. The welcoming has been great. I mean, just in general, everywhere you go.
Yeah, that's one of the things about this winery and the B&B aspect. It was started by Bob and Nadine Vegan. And so it's a priest and a nun that got together, and they had a daughter named Marie Chantal. So they left. They're still involved with the church. And so he's still a deacon, Bob is. And so it's it's a funny story, but then they named this place after her, and they bought this in the mid-'80s. And you know, they came up here, and this used to be a cherry orchard, and they bought it and put in all these vines. And we were talking to one of the neighbors the other day who wanted to start selling us some grapes and telling us, like, I remember when he first came by talking about a chateau and grapes, and you know, I'm growing cherries, I've never heard any of these words. You're like, wow. Chateau,
you know? Exactly.
And so it's kind of it's, you know, humble beginnings for something where it's kind of gotten pretty big.
Very humble. I'm assuming she wasn't a nun anymore.
No, yeah, so not anymore.
Just be clear on that.
No. Yeah, it's kind of no.
Yeah. Well, it's not exactly an unusual story, though.
No, yeah. Well, they found something very special with each other.
I would say.
yeah, still see them around. They're still here today. And
nice. Do they live up here?
Yeah, yep. They live. So they started the B&B. It's their house, and they still live upstairs in the executive apartment.
Kind of. I saw the sign as we pulled up. Yep. Very nice. And when was the winery originally opened again?
So the vines were planted in 84, and they sold the fruit for a while, and then the first vintage was like 1991.
Roughly, can you tell me how far we are from the tip of the peninsula here?
Yeah, so the Old Mission Peninsula is about 17 miles long, 18 miles long, and we are about 15 miles out. And so the widest point of this peninsula is like about 4 or 5 miles wide, so you're never more than a couple miles from the water anywhere on this peninsula.
Yeah, you could see that.
Yeah.
In summertime, do you get crazy wild storms here, I mean, being that you have the water there?
No, not. Well, we've had a couple in the last few years, and those kind of the anomalies have become more normal for us. We've had a few weird things in the last couple of years where hailstorms have popped in. 2015, we had what we called the triple threat year. It was a pretty bad, hard winter where, you know, that was the polar vortex year, and we got like negative 27 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the summer we had a hailstorm, and it was this big, crazy green cloud that just came across and just dumped on us a bunch of hail. And, you know, 20 minutes later, half the power's out around here, and then you can't get to town for 2 days because all these trees are down. And it was crazy. I was ahead of it by like 5 minutes.
I'm sure there were one or two people screaming the world is over or something like that.
It was crazy, yeah. And then this year we had another little hail squall that hit one vineyard. You know, just one tiny vineyard got hit. Yeah, lost half its fruit in 10 minutes, 15
wow,
minutes.
That's just, that's, you know, the risk of farming is that you're at the Mother Nature's whim.
Yeah, it's legalized gambling.
Yeah, that's what many winemakers have said.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. So have you had a chance to ever make wine in any other part of the world? Have you done any traveling in that regard to make wine?
No. With Michigan Fruit, it's very specialized. And so when I came out of school, having studied this the way it is here, is much more useful to be here. We have a bigger bag of tricks here that if you go somewhere else, it's almost a little bit easier in the sense. One of the researchers at Michigan State University, Paolo Sabatini, has done these calculations to show, in Napa, you get a plus or minus 5% variation in heat accumulation per year. And we see about a swing of 25 to 30% plus or minus. So we have beautiful Napa-like years, like literally that many heating growing degree days. And then we have Nova Scotia years that are, so you have to have a more extensive bag of tricks to deal with things, you know, from everything from, you know, even, you know, some years you have to do what you do in Napa where you have to acidify and adjust pHs that way. And then there's other years where it's perfect, you don't do anything. And then there are years where, you know, your acids are higher than your bricks. And you're, what do you do? You know? And so we've had 2009, we did that. And, you know, early on, everybody disliked the wines, and then they're still hanging on because they had so much acidity and they're so bright and pretty, you know, like 10 years later, 11 years later, if you can find them, they're like, holy cow, you know, what happened? You know?
Are some of your wines here ageable?
Yeah. I've recently gone back in the last 10 years or so of our Pinot Gris, and so all those are still hanging on, which is interesting to say for Pinot Grigio.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know?
Yeah.
But you know what we do with it is a little different in the sense that we barrel ferment in a bunch of small old oak barrels that are at least 10 years old, and then we batonnage it once a month and stir it up and get the lees built
only
up.
Once a month though.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. The other part is that with our temperatures here in our subcellar, it's pretty cold, so our aging and development is very, very slow in the barrel room. So, you know, oxygen absorbs much faster, closer to 65 degrees Fahrenheit. For every degree below, you lose about 10% of your oxygen uptake. So our barrel programs went from when they were upstairs and we had less wine we were making, you know, a year to now 2 to 3 years on some wines. It just takes much, much longer to have that development take place. And so with our Pinot Gris, it's still less than a year, but that entire time we were developing that, that wine, I always pull it from the barrels right around you get that first flush of leesiness, you know. So I want the fruit to still be there, but you still get this background leesiness that kind of frames it and gives it that longevity too, those extra polysaccharides and all those other little flavor things going on in the background.
Interesting. I don't think a lot of people would think of wanting, of trying to age it. And again, true, in our society in America, most people buy wine to drink that night.
Yeah.
It's not like they're going to be laying it down.
Yeah.
So, but still, it's nice to know that you can do that.
Yeah, I mean, recognize, so that, you know, 75% of wine is drank in 48 hours of purchase, so not all of our wines are set up for that. And so not all of our wines are set up for that, but it's, you know, it's a long-term kind of thing for right. some things. In good years and in warmer years, or in, for some of the reds, they still do retain a fair amount of acidity and structural elements that give them the longevity that when we taste them, like our current, it's 2018, and our 2012 reserve Pinot Noirs are just kind of coming into their own. So it's, we get these very, very fruity wines. It's kind of one of the hallmarks of this area is very bright aromatics. And so just part of it's the soils we have, part of it's the climate, you know, it just depends on the site and where it's at. Because we have clay sites that just get crazy body to them that we don't see in the other sites, you know.
It was interesting, you kind of paused for a moment to think of what year you're in, because, you know, yeah. as a winemaker, you're kind of, I've said this many, many times, you're living in the past, present, and the future simultaneously.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit crazy when you have to think about it.
It's confusing yeah. at times, yeah. I mean, you know, some people have, you know, a handful of kids. We've got, I think this, for Chateau Chantal, I mean, like 35 products a year, so there's 35 kids a year going out the door wondering where they're going and what's going to happen. Are they going to be treated well? You know,
yeah, right.
Hopefully most of them get drank for a good time.
That would be good.
Yeah.
And you said you were doing about 20,000 cases here, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cool. Now, do you live near here?
Yeah, I live north of here a few miles. So
it's around the peninsula.
Yeah. So days like this, it's a little more easy for me to get around.
So but before we sat down, you know, the one reason I love doing this is to hear stories from winemakers. And I've often said this is not a, for the light at heart, it can be very dangerous work.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be fun, crazy, and all that kind of stuff. Any stories you can think of that you'd like to pass on and from your own experience?
We've done a lot of things. you know, during harvest, I kind of often refer to the fact that I'm on an elliptical orbit with the earth, because you kind of stop seeing me around outside of the winery for about 2 or 3 months a year. And in that time, I don't talk to like normal people. It's all harvest people, and we're all in it together. And it's like pirate ship kind of, you know. And so things, you get pretty strange, and you're here, you know, 14, 18 hours a day for, you know, 2 months sometimes. And so, yeah. And then, you know, just you're here that much, and it gives you more opportunity to do stupid things and, you know, have things happen. You know, I mean, everything from, you know, when you're dumping a bin, we've, you know, the bottoms pop off and the bins fall in the conveyor belt. And
nice.
You're like, oh, great, let's stop what we were doing, you know, get out some straps and try to pull this thing out and spend the next 15 minutes scheming. You know, everybody becomes an engineer real quick, and we try to sort out how we're going to separate these two pieces of equipment that are now stuck together. So I know that there's so many other times when you're just moving so quick. I mean, one of my first years here, the cellars were separated before we moved into the big main cellar, and you couldn't see one from the other. So you turn on the pump, and you know, 150 feet away, and then you let it run for a couple minutes. You come back down, and you're like, "Well, I forgot to shut the door on the reserve Chardonnay," you know. So the floor is covered with expensive Chardonnay, and run up and close the door. Like, well, luckily I caught that pretty quick. And what you realize pretty fast in the winery is how big of a mess a little bit of wine can make, because when you think of a surface area of something, it's like, you know, an eighth of an inch thick crossing, you know, 100 square feet, you know, you might be talking about a gallon or two. And it looks terrible, especially when it's red. And yeah. You feel bad, and, you know, you wonder if you should have done that or not. And then you go and you actually calculate it, and you're like, okay, you know, this was not so bad. It was only a couple $100 mistake.
Yeah, that's not bad.
You know, and every tank could be a chance to lose $50,000. So, you know, it's try not to remind the guys of that when they're doing it.
Yeah, you don't want to think about the dollars involved.
No, you can't.
That's very scary.
Yeah.
So what do you like to drink as a winemaker?
Oh, goodness. It's always the question. It's kind of what's cool about here is the range of different things that we have, you know. So being a relatively young region, we have a lot of different varieties that we get to play with. And in every year, kind of, we get ones that hit better than others. And you know, with the variability in seasons, they all kind of develop differently, you know. And so there are, and they're fun ones that we have here that you don't find anywhere else, like Wurzgemeiner.
Right.
You know, that's a cool one. And it just gets such a unique character here that can be really cool. One that, like one I think we do very, very consistently well here is Pinot Grigio and Pinot Gris. It's just a nice variety for this area that develops, and you get great flavors from almost every year. And it's not something that most people are like, oh, that's amazing Pinot Gris, you know. But then, but when you find one, you realize why it's special, you know. And then the other fun ones we have are like Auxerrois. We've got a small vineyard of that with one of our, basically a cellar employee. He started here, he came from MSU as well, and he got out of college and talked him into planting a couple acres of Auxerrois. And everybody's like, what is that? Why would you do that? So it's a Alsatian white variety, and it's commonly blended or field planted with Pinot Blanc. And so you might see on a wine from Alsace a Pinot Auxerrois, or they just call it Pinot Blanc because it's allowed to be called that.
Yeah.
And so we do that one in old oak barrels as well. And you know, but we, you know, I make wine for Hawthorne as well, so we sell that at Hawthorne Vineyards. But it's a crazy white variety that's cool for this area because it ripens so early, so you get this really long time after you pick it for the vines to acclimate and do their thing and be, and they're more consistently productive for us.
Do you make your own wine?
Oh yeah, we have lots of stuff going on.
I mean personally?
Yeah.
Oh.
Like not in my house anymore.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm not there.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't imagine. It would have rotted, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got some vineyards in my house, and I planted a bunch of test varieties too. So we had the research vineyards at MSU, and when I got out of school, a lot of these varieties still didn't have names. And so you're planting numbered varieties from several ones from Cornell, and then a couple of years later, they all got names, and now we have Coro Noir and Noiré, and Treminet was already named at that point. And then I planted what is now known as Aramella. And so, and then with Michigan State, my major professor Stan retired, and then the research winery kind of closed down until it was replaced by a new guy, Paolo. And so I got to take all those small little lots and bring them here and do side projects here and do lots of little experiments. So there's lots of other blocks from there that I got to play with for many years. So over the years, I was always making these side projects where send everybody else home at like midnight and hang out here till 2 a.m. pressing like 5 gallons of Auxerrois, you know, or of a Treminet. It's like, well, why am I doing this? This is crazy.
Because it's there.
Yeah, because I have to. It's going to go on the ground if I don't do it. Who's going to drink this? It's not, you know, the raccoons can't have it.
Yeah, right.
So I kept doing that for years. And then Mark was like, well, you should just, you know, do this for yourself. And I was like, you know, and then if you want, you can sell it back to us if you want, but you don't have to. And so through time, what I've done is we started just making all these weird little project wines and kind of referring to them jokingly as once-in-a-lifetime wines because it's 5 gallons from a vineyard that no longer exists because they ripped it out last year. It's a test vineyard that was only meant to be there for 10 years kind of a thing. And I have all these other little blocks. And so we started a little side project we were calling the 1855 Project, which is the year that Michigan State University started because these were all Michigan State University kind of based farms. And so we have all these little side things. So I stopped doing it at home because I just didn't have space and I didn't have time. And
it's like a monster taking over.
Yeah. And so, we throttled back a little bit this year and went home early a couple nights, slept, crazy stuff.
Yes. Not to point out the negative, but I mean, did you have some failures? I imagine you did have a few.
Well, there's all kinds of weird stuff that happens with wine.
But it was this kind of stuff that you thought, I really, really feel good about this. Then you take the taste and you're like, what was I thinking?
Well, the thing with a lot of those kinds of wines is they're so new, you don't always know what to do with them, right? And so you have these, it's like, luckily I had these in school and had plenty of opportunity to see them go right and wrong there. But with a lot of them, like with the reds, like one of the things I was doing with some of the Cornell red varieties, the Coro Noir and Noiré, is they never seem to accumulate high Brix. You know, you always pick them at like 19 at the high end, maybe 20, which is fine. But I always tried to pick them later and later to see if they could do something special. And then they just never tasted good at that point. So I have all these like, oh, I'm gonna make these big red wines, all these very fruity varieties, and then you're like, well, this is dumb, because I don't even like drinking them, and got these cases of them in my basement at home.
Man.
And so you open them every once in a while as a curiosity, and then so this year I went completely the opposite direction. It's like, screw this, I'm gonna pick them early and make them very fruity. And then I just, well, I'm not even gonna make red out of them this year, I'm gonna make rosé. So I went the other direction and made me really nice, pretty rosé.
So, wow.
And so I think what I'll do is maybe in the future split the difference and go more down the fruity red, because they don't have the structural elements that you get from like a vinifera. You know, they're inverted, you know, so, you know, with vinifera you get like a 10-to-1 tannin to anthocyanin ratio, and then you get into hybrid varieties, or not even hybrids, I'm trying to start calling them resistant varieties, because hybrids kind of has a negative connotation to it.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of grape racists out there that don't think that they're as good. Yeah, and so, but they're not. They're different, they're their own thing, and there's plenty of advantages to using them. Like you, like in the vineyard, like Noiré in the vineyard is so easy to grow. It just goes on its own, and you can spray it half as much, and you know, it's just this beast, you know. And then you can ignore them more, and you're moving back into a much less tractor time, more free time kind of scenarios. And so there's, but then, you know, again, it's like with Cabernet Franc that gets pyrazines. You know, you end up, are you hating something for being itself, or is it a fault? You know, you end up into this gray area of like, is it good? Is it bad? Should it be this way? I mean, it's part of its genetics, you know. Just because some places you can get beyond that doesn't mean, you know, in its native range it did that, you know. And so there's this whole gray area with some of these, and just figuring out what they do and how they perform and what's the best way to make them. You know?
You're half winemaker and half mad scientist.
Yeah, that's you can go down in the cellar right now and see lots of experiments going on.
I imagine some horror sights and horror music playing in the background.
Yeah.
And some good stuff too.
Yeah, I was thinking I should outfit my lab with lights so when people walk by, like a spaceship's landing.
Yeah,
you know,
you should, actually.
Freak people out.
Yeah, why not add to the experience?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Brian, we're here at the tasting room, and I'm assuming that visitors can come by here anytime, or do they have to make an appointment? How does that process work here?
Yeah, so we're open, I think, something like 360 days a year in the tasting room. So for the most part, it's walk-in, you show up when you want, but if you have groups, we generally like to treat you well, and you should call ahead so that we can make sure that there's someone here to, you know, take care of that. But beyond that, we're here pretty much every day except for the major holidays.
Cool. Yeah. And I assume you guys have a website. What is that website?
It's chateauchantal.com. So, yeah, all of our wines are available there. And then, like with our wine club, you can get on that. And then what we're starting to do with the wine club stuff is some of these weird things I've been talking about, we started releasing them to the wine club because I had so many of these. And, you know, all the people here that work here can drink a fair amount of wine, but at a certain point, when you calculate out, if you were to drink like a couple bottles a day, if you tried your hardest, you know, per person, you're talking a couple hundred gallons a year, right? And so, and you're legally allowed to make that at home, by the way, 250 gallons. But, you know, so we had all these little lots that we kept popping up and putting in the library, and, you know, we'd drink them and share them, and then it's like, well, this is cool, why aren't we, you know, not everybody's going to get a chance to taste this, but so one of the ones we always have been doing, because we have was the Merlot, and so we joke around, we just make a Merlittle, you know, it's not enough for everybody, it's just a Merlittle. And then this year we made a Merlot, and so we have this little batch that we set aside that we're going to release probably shortly, the next couple of months, to wine club people. And then we have all these other little test blocks that we've been doing for years, like we have 2 rows of Sauvignon Blanc that we really like, and, you know, try as we might, you know, it's a little more than we should probably drink on our own. Yeah. And so we should start sharing these things, and that's kind of some of the impetus, and so all these other little research projects, you know, and these other side things, we have plantings, and sure, try to have, you know, if it's worthwhile we release it, if it's not, then, you know, disappears. And that's winemaking, though, is nobody wants, you know, very, very focused on problems.
Yeah, well, you are a problem solver when you get right down to it.
Yeah, it's a lot of quick decisions at harvest, trying to figure out where, what's going to go where, and how we're going to, what we're going to do with it, you know.
Exactly.
With harvests like this, where it's a little bit cooler, you know, you're not just doing your normal thing, you've got to figure out how, you know, early in the season, it's like, oh, this is great, you know, all these whites are coming in beautiful. Then you get towards the end, you're like, well, this may not be a Cab Franc here. We'll see. And then you just do what you can. And then we came out of some of the fermentations like, well, wait a second, you know, this did turn out. And this is that what I was talking about earlier is not being like against something for being what it is, you know, right. like the Cab Franc had low expectations because, you know, it wasn't a really hot year and you don't have the same tannin development. But then when you get down to the end, it's like, well, this is coarse now, but the building blocks are there for something more interesting long term. And then you start to, you know, you can create a lot of work for yourself going down this road.
Well, I can't even imagine.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, either way, thanks very much for making the time today, especially on this crazy snowy day, and the snow really hasn't stopped yet. So,
it'll be a fun ride home.
It'll be a lot of fun ride home. Yeah. But thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
All right.
Learn more by visiting Chateau Chantal or check out MichiganWineCollaborative.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.